Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 26, 2006, and today's session is entitled Female Circumcision Controversy, an Open-Minded Approach, presented by Mwenda Ntaringwi, number NTM-2006-03. Let's listen in.
I've seen a number of faces in the last few days. Mwenda Ntaringwi, I'm an anthropologist. I teach at Augustana College. Mostly interested in issues that relate to culture. And my thinking is that if there was more cultural understanding, we would live a better life than we do today. And so what I do is I try to introduce topics that I am sure will be controversial. And out of controversy, then we will see how can we reconcile our differences in perceptions. And you all know, if you introduce topics like corporal punishment, the death penalty, you know, pro-life, pro-choice, all those always makes people have very strong opinions. Because they, in most cases, we don't want to see the other side. Or we know we're so strongly convinced that we are right, that the other person must be wrong. But out of it, we learn a lot. If we listen, we'll learn why this person is on this position and this other person is on this position. So I'm introducing one of the topics that has been of controversy for a long time, on female circumcision. And before I do that, I wanted to introduce you to a book that I use with my students. It's called Parallel Worlds, and it's by Alma Gottlieb and Philip Graham. Alma is an anthropologist, and Philip is a writer, fiction writer. They're both at the University of Illinois, and they went in late 70s, early 80s to a small village in Ivory Coast in West Africa. Alma was interested in documenting the life of a very small, unknown tribe in West Africa. And she was looking for a place to stay and write about their belief systems. And so what they did is they wrote their accounts almost in parallel. But the writer, what he was seeing and thinking, and the anthropologist, what she was seeing and thinking, and they put them together. So it's a very interesting story of two perspectives between a husband and a wife and what they were experiencing in this. But one of the things that is interesting in this book is that they said they resisted the what they call now the hindsight. They resisted changing what they did when they were there. And so when they kept their diaries, they wanted to people to read what they were actually going through. And I wanted to read something that is very, sometimes, very disturbing for readers as well as the writers themselves. And then it will introduce us into the topic of controversy. How can you witness something that you think is wrong and just write about it? Do you intervene and change what is going on, or do you leave and say, okay, I'll come back? And those of you that were in my first session, remember the case of a child abandoned in the savannah, and we said, this child can be treated. But once you treat this child, what do you do? Because it's part of a larger culture. Unless you change the entire system, then one person's change may not be very much of a difference. So they've just come from a funeral, visiting, they've made friends. It's in the village, they've been accepted, they have a home to stay. And so this is Alma now telling us about something that happened at night. That night, Philip and I were awakened by screams. Half dreaming, I thought I was back in Bangalo. I, as mother, wailing her sorrow, and the painful memory roused me. Philip and I dressed and hurried out anxiously. We recognized the voice. It was Nakoyan's. We followed the sound of her cries. Already, there was a small gathering outside the house in our family's compound. From inside the room came the howls of a woman in near hysteria. "What could they be doing to Nakoya now?" I asked Philip. "Poor thing," he said. "God only knows. Nakoya's aunt Asao joined us." "That little black thing," she said. "She is really rotten. She should just sleep with her husband, and that would be the end of that. But she says she doesn't like him." I couldn't help but say, "That's not why you marry someone." Asao snapped back. "Gosu is her cousin. He is in the family. He is the perfect man for her to marry. Why doesn't Nakoyan see that?" I liked Asao and couldn't help feeling disappointment at her elevation of duty over love. The romantic in me wasn't living up to the demands of cultural relativity that had originally attracted me to my discipline. The moral ground of anthropology never seemed shakier. The screams started up again. "What are they doing in there?" I asked, dreading the answer. They are forcing her to sleep with Gosu," Asao said. Philip's shocked face must have reflected my own. I felt the urge to vomit, faint, flee, anything to distance myself from this news, these screams, this procrastinating system of marriage that brooked no dissent. "Who is forcing her?" I made myself ask. "Andama and some other relatives of hers," she answered brusquely. A fresh batch of cries pierced the starry night. The door opened and Che Kofi, Asao's husband, came up, cursing and sweating. Those around us flocked to the door and peeked into the room. I forced myself to look at that which I dreaded most. On an iron bed lay Nakoyan on her back, naked and reeling like a trapped antelope, both defiant and defeated, her left leg chained to a nearby window bar, her hands tied behind her back with the black strips of rubber I'd seen men use to secure packages on their bicycles. Screaming, she was trying with all her force to break free of her bonds. The other man in the room struggled to hold her down, one leg free, as Gosu, naked himself, approached her. I wanted to run in and unknot those rubber strips, release Nakoyan's hands, and carry her out of the room. But before I could move, Che Kofi went back inside and shut the door. "Philip," I said, "shouldn't we drive to Biakro and call the police? Surely rape was illegal in this country, and the whole gang, rapist accomplices, and their approving onlookers would be punished. Nakoyan would be allowed to marry the man of her choice." Before Philip could reply, Nakoyan's mother and her older sister began to curse her. "She should just marry him," the old woman hissed, her face a knot of fury. "Otherwise, she should leave the village. If she finds good luck or bad somewhere else, that will be her affair. Meanwhile, if I die, she will hear about it and she will die too." Was this the sweet, meek woman whom Philip and I greeted every day on our morning rounds? The woman who frequently clasped my hands to her chest, who once had led me into her house to show me some herbal remedies for her worsening cataracts? Hearing Nakoyan's own mother condemn her, I felt less sure of my position. In any case, even if Philip and I did inform the police of the rape, the Gandamins might just shrug off the event as local village custom and laugh at our intrusion. Nor was I confident Nakoyan herself would be grateful to me for interfering. Just last week, Gosu had told me that his father had consulted the divine Lamin, who had pronounced that Nakoyan was possessed by a male spirit of a clan who was especially jealous of human rivals. If the spirit husband were propitiated with a chicken sacrifice, he would release Nakoyan to Gosu. Had she accepted this explanation? If so, perhaps tonight's rape was also an exorcism. Contemplating such questions, unanswerable for the moment, sapped my will to take action. I turned to Philip and said, "I hate to say it, but I think we have to stay." Philip nodded unhappily, unwilling to interfere in this crucial decision in my fieldwork. I forced myself to take out my notebook. And it goes on and on and on. And so that's an experience as an anthropologist that brings about a torn part of it. What do you do? And she goes on to say it reminds her of seeing pictures of mutilated bodies of children in Vietnam. And she was wondering, why couldn't the people taking the pictures intervene? And so she's found herself in the same situation. So what should she have done is our first question here. What should she have done? She's witnessing something where the person who is being forced to sleep with this man who's supposed to marry her does not like it. So at least she could be on the side of Nakoya. But it seems like there's a lot of force that is against her wishes as well. What do you think should happen in such a situation?
Well, in our culture, I'd like to take those people and just grab, you know, get the girl out of there. That's terrible. Mm-hmm. But in that culture, they just think that that's normal, huh?
So do you just lift your hands and say, well, it's your culture, just leave it, forget it?
Well, no. I don't know. They probably wouldn't like me doing anything, would they?
Two against how many hundreds?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder though if they had made a vocal protest, if she and her husband, Philip, and she both chose to say, no, this isn't right, mm-hmm. to force her, if that might have made a difference. If they
but
didn't
it seems
say
like she
something.
Didn't, yeah, she didn't want to do that.
Yeah, she didn't want to do that because of her relationship with the other people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But still, you would think that you would have to do it if that really did bother you that much. I think you'd have to make this.
What if it meant losing her stand in the village? And she was there to stay for a year,
right.
and do her field work, record the lives and more.
Also the stand of the girl.
So she stand with the girl and they get all kicked out of the village and that's the end of her.
Well, and you said even also, I think one part that she wasn't sure that the girl would appreciate her doing that, that maybe that, even though she was screaming, she wouldn't appreciate her.
Would that put the girl's life in danger by stopping them too? And put it in danger in a different way? If they were able to stop that?
It seems like the mother is saying if she doesn't want to go through this, then she should leave the village.
Okay.
So she becomes almost an outcast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is a big struggle. What do you do when you are not able to survive in that culture if you don't follow the cultural requirements?
I think you do sacrifice what you're trying to accomplish for yourself. Mm-hmm. When those men were stranded on Everest, the guy that was up there making the documentary set the documentary aside and he rescued, or tried, and he did rescue some people.
Mm-hmm.
He said, this is more important than my film, and that is more important than their work.
Yeah.
Now whether they can accomplish something, that's another matter.
That's true. I think sometimes you have to give up what you think is beneficial to you in order to do what is right.
As an anthropologist, are they there mostly to document and observe, but not to change?
Yeah. Yes.
So it wouldn't be their purpose to educate or to suggest another way? I mean, even just the matter of her marrying a cousin would be something I'd be concerned about.
Yes. But you see, in the tradition, marrying a cousin makes sure that all the people stay together instead of, you know, dispersing them out into other groups.
I think the other thing you have to look at is this a common occurrence or is this out of the norm?
It seems that her refusal
is
out of the norm.
Right.
And so she's rebelling. I mean, that's probably how cultures change. She's rebelling. And one would hope that maybe she will leave the village and go into the city and find a new life, and she doesn't need to come back. But the question still remains, what happens to the rest that stay? Yes?
Would you clarify the part about the chicken being sacrificed? And then
They say that she was possessed with a husband's spirit. And so they may interpret her screaming and refusal as not her own refusal, but the work of a spirit that was in her. Therefore, even the rape itself could be seen as exorcism, to remove the spirit that has come over her.
So the anthropologist really is in a dilemma because she doesn't know, like if she did interrupt, maybe, as she said, that the girl would not be happy about that being interrupted.
And maybe she believes that she also has been possessed. And then she'll say, well, it wasn't me who was screaming. In fact, when you go on, and Alma says she met Nakoyan much later, and she was happy and wasn't complaining, and she wondered, you're behaving like nothing happened to you the other night. So it could be very confusing.
Yes. So another way of seeing this is that from inside the culture, this is seen as the marriage of two families, mm-hmm. or clans.
Yes.
And the priority there is the greater community instead of the individual.
Yes.
And so to intervene on this situation would be hurtful to two clans.
To the community, to the people involved, to the families.
Yeah.
But Alma is thinking, well, if this individual doesn't want to go through this, mm-hmm. then the individual's wishes must be respected. And the people are saying, no, this is not about her. This is about a union between families, you know, so that life can go on, as it has always done in this community.
So for an outsider coming from a society where the individuals get married, it's a different picture.
And it's very hard to accept that.
Yeah.
That is one of the ways of getting married. That is how you actually get initiated into getting married. Well, let's turn our lens, after looking at this topic, to female circumcision. And one of the challenges that anthropologists face, again, is that how do you deal with something that you know is not physiologically, biologically necessary? It is a cultural practice that is actually medically not good for the person. It leads into complications, you know, medical complications. How do you deal with this? And the question has been, should there be an intervention from outside? Because we have more facts, you know, about what happens to women when they go through this. And of course, there are very different types of female circumcision, from the mere cutting of the clitoris to complete excision, you know, what is called among the communities in the Sudan. And so there's a whole range or a spectrum of the different practices, but in either way, is very much tied to a tradition that has been going on. And the question is, how do we respect the culture and the practice when we have information that tells us this is not okay? And one of the things that we find ourselves almost in a dilemma with is that we want to be culturally sensitive, we want to respect the culture, but also we, at least now in the last 30, 40 years, anthropologists have been interested in social justice, you know? So how do you translate your desire to respect the culture with the need for social justice? And that has brought about issues on circumcision. But it's not only anthropologists. I mean, church groups, missionaries have tried this. In my own country, in Kenya, in 1902, when the first missionaries arrived in my home area, they were against circumcision. But in the year 2006 now, there is about 90% circumcision rate among even groups that were that received the message of the missionaries. So what's going on, and how can you change this? And that's the dilemma. How can you change it? And one of the things that has happened thus far is for people to advocate for legislation. They say, okay, if the government makes it illegal, then people have a right to go in and say, okay, you are doing something illegal, and we'll report you to the government. That happened, I think, in the 50s with the colonial government in Kenya, for instance. And before the law could be initiated, there was a movement among the girls themselves who said, we will circumcise ourselves before the law comes into force. And we're asking ourselves, why is it so necessary? What is going on? And one of the things we realize is that it is really a very much part of the culture. In many communities, it is the anthropologists have interviewed women who've been circumcised, women who themselves are the circumcisers, and those who are waiting to be circumcised. And they have different reasons that they give. One of them is, at least among some groups in the Sudan, is they say, what they do this because they want to feminize the woman. That the female genitalia before circumcision is almost similar to the male genitalia. So they want to remove that which almost resembles the male genitalia so that they can be female. Okay? Others say, well, it's for the pleasure of their husband during sexual intercourse. And others report that it's to prepare them for marriage. This is a rite of passage. And before you get married, among the Maasai in Kenya, for instance, a girl gets circumcised a day or two before she gets married. So it is the ritual before you, which marks your movement from childhood to adulthood. And the other one is that it is to ascertain your own group or ethnic identity. I remember one of my teachers in high school, much later he became almost obsessed with his ethnic identity, and at a later stage had forced his wife to get circumcised. Because he thought, this is our tradition. So it is not really that these people who practice it don't have enough knowledge. I mean, he was a biology teacher in high school. So you would expect that he knows all the, you know, the intricacies. But he said, for you to be a true person in this ethnic group, you have to go through this ritual. And the other one, of course, is to a certain to give somebody certain rights when you move from childhood to adulthood through marriage. You have certain rights and certain respects and values that are bestowed upon you. And if you don't move through that circumcision, then you're constantly considered a child. And no, in certain communities, no man will marry a woman who's not circumcised. So here, this huge cultural almost baggage with you that says, this is what happens. This is our tradition. You want to live here, you want to be part of this community, then you do what needs to happen. So what are some of the reasons that we would give as an explanation for trying to stop this? And we can go through a number that I've given. Yes.
When I was in Tanzania in 2004, we listened to a Tanzanian minister, I think he was actually a minister of transportation, mm-hmm. but he talked about a lot of these cultural things, and this subject came up. And he said that what they were trying to do in his particular tribe, where this was very common practice, a nobleman would get a husband without having this done. And so if that was the way it was, mm-hmm. if you wanted to be a part of that community, that was done. But he said what they were trying to do was to tell the grandmothers and the elders, because those are the ones that carry out the procedures in that particular community, was that their women in this tribe were not looking good in the hospitals. They weren't able to deliver their babies without many complications, mm-hmm. and without, so that it was a matter of pride, yeah. that our women are having infections and mm-hmm. scar tissue, and they're not delivering babies easy like they should, and hoping that going from that direction, not that it was terrible or bad or awful,
yeah.
but that it didn't look good
yeah.
for what was happening later.
And if the community, as I would imagine, values children, you know, you'd say, this complicates getting new members of the community. Then that might be a way of changing the tradition. Anybody else? What would happen? Or why are we...
You mentioned the notion of justice is something that, you know, a lot of people struggle with, including anthropologists.
Yes. Right?
But if we are accepting that no tradition, doesn't matter ours or any community anywhere in the world, Africa, anywhere else, it's not absolute. There's nothing unchangeable. There's nothing somehow carved in stone by any of their traditions. And that we should change the debate that any other tradition is open to change as much as ours. We don't all agree what justice is about, but if we can start, that there becomes a beginning of a conversation at that stage. So I guess this is where some of the, you can leverage whatever local values are, right? Status of the community vis-a-vis other, you know, values of children, some of those kinds of things. But what, where do we get started to get justice on the table? And that's the question.
Where do we start?
Yes.
To get justice on the table. I mean, do we see it from the other side, be with the culture, or do we see it from this side where we don't practice it? You know, and I did a session among pastors in Mozambique, and I asked them this similar question. And they said, I think I remember one pastor saying, you know, sometimes you don't have to wait for the people to see the justice from the other end. And then I told them, because I knew that in their culture, at least among, in the northern Mozambique, they are very strict on male circumcision. So I said, in the same breath, should we stop male circumcision? And there was an uproar. They said, no way, this is our tradition. You cannot do that. And I said, okay, how is it different for those that say the same of female circumcision? And then we started talking from there. We said, okay, the way you feel vehemently tied to that tradition of male circumcision is the same way members of communities that circumcise women feel about it. And so how do you change? And some of the ways that people have approached it is to ask what are the underlying meanings. What is it to be a woman in this society? And one of the things that comes out most of the time is that you ought to be able to go through pain. So pain is the bridge that you cross to become a fully accepted adult. Now, think of Western people thinking of that. You know, when many years ago, pain was seen as the last thing that you can use for punishment. You know? So you're coming in here and you wonder, why would anybody want to go through pain? You know, you get a small headache, pop in a Tylenol. You know, you don't wait it out, even if it's a sort of a headache from too much sun, or, you know, you need to take lots of water and just relax. No, pain is not something that a lot of people in the West can deal with, but on the other side, people are saying you have to go through pain because life is painful. You gotta be prepared for life. Being married, being a mother is a tough life. So if you're able to go through this painful experience, then you're being prepared to face your life as a mother. In fact, for male, at least among the Maasai, for the male circumcision, they pride themselves in not even wincing a muscle when you're going through that. And there's no...
And that's not done when they're babies either.
No, that it's done when they're 15, 16. So if you move as if you're showing any pain, you are letting down the entire family, the entire clan, and you're an embarrassment. And people will talk about you. Oh, that's the one who was afraid of the knife, you know, and nobody would want to marry their daughter to you because you can't protect her. So it's a big thing. Something that you consider to be avoided suddenly becomes the marker of who can pass this test. And so we have to understand that. And understand it in a context where, yes, this is what it means to us, because we view motherhood as this. We view going through motherhood and getting married as this. And again, one of the challenges that have been there is most of the times that people have tried to intervene in any sort of female circumcision, they've always and always dealt with women. And they've never included men in it. You know? But remember, we talked about they want to please their husbands, or husbands, or men will not marry women or not circumcised. Can you imagine if suddenly we turn and say, no man will marry a woman who's circumcised in that community? You know, if you had a magic wand and you say, okay, put in this amen and say, I'm not touching any woman who is circumcised in my community as a wife. It would change. So people now are trying to say, okay, what can we do as a combined effort of men and women in the society? And one of the things that has happened is they are trying to have alternatives to female circumcision. Where you, because female circumcision is not just the operation. It includes sex education, includes being trained on what is expected of you as a member of a community now that you've become a mother. In fact, even 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old girls who've been circumcised are immediately given an adult status. And so when you go through the operation, it is just one, it's just but one part of a large system where you are taught how to be a member of this community. And therefore, people are saying, well, there is value in that, but how can we do it without going through the operation? And there have been some successes in some communities where the girls will go through a sequence of training, you know, from local members of the community. What were they taught about their own sexuality, their own history of being members of this community. And then they have a coming out ceremony. But also there have been some not so successful alternative programs where those that have been circumcised will taunt the uncircumcised girls. And the ones that have gone through the alternative circumcision operation will finally end up going through the actual operation, which includes
peer pressure.
Yeah, peer pressure. And that has become a major, major challenge. There are communities still in many parts where there's between 80 and 98% circumcision rate for the girls. And the tough thing is that it is very private. And so nobody, you know, it's not like you can just come into the household or bust into the village and say, okay, stop whatever you're doing. It's very secretive. And the minute people know that there's legislation or there are people against it, they feel like they want to go through it just to defy this. What is also interesting, though, it's the globalized nature of this debate on circumcision. A friend of mine who is an anthropologist was called upon to a court case where a woman, I think from East Africa, was filing for asylum on the claims that she was fleeing from being circumcised. The defense lawyer, you know, had trouble establishing, was she fleeing from a specific family? Who was it that is forcing her to get circumcised? You know, who do you sue? Who do you say is the person who is forcing her? Because nobody really says it is the expected traditional norm of the community. And if you don't go through it, then you feel like an outcast. Anyway, the case went on, but the sad thing is that the girl actually was from a community that does not circumcise girls. And she had claimed she was from another community that is known worldwide to circumcise girls. She had taken up the discourse on circumcision and wanted to use it. She'd come in, I think, I'd leave her visa, and now started saying, well, I am running away from this cruel tradition, and I need to be given asylum, because if I go back, I'll be forcefully circumcised. I mean, there are cases of girls who ran away and they were awarded asylum. And so what my friend did was just go, because she worked with the community that the girl claimed to be from, and she started talking to her in the local language. She said, so what really is going on? And she said, I don't understand what you're saying. Because she didn't speak a word of the language. Uh-huh. So how, what are you really, where are you from? And they found out she's from another ethnic group, and she was trying to use this as a way of asylum. So you can see that it also become almost a discourse of, I mean, the discourse has been taken up because we have this very strong opinion about it, and people are taking advantage of it. But what do we do as members of a society that this community that is interested in social justice, knowing all these complications of culture? I mean, I read this story because it is very similar, that the people participating in it, in fact, Nakoyan's mother says she should go away and die somewhere. The mother is part of this culture that wants to forcefully marry her daughter.
We start with our commonalities in the character building process, coming of age. All of our cultures know that our youth need to be strengthened to participate adequately in our adult world. So many challenges are difficult for our youth. Mm-hmm. And as a parent, I can only applaud any parent who wants to strengthen their children for being able to participate as strong, confident adults in the world. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that everything I've done is right, or that it couldn't be done better, or it couldn't change. But we can start with character building as a common shared value, that any change or alternative that I would suggest or would have to be on the table would have to fulfill that need for strengthening the character of our youth. Certainly, and we know that's a problem here.
Yes.
There's parallels. We can't just brag that we do all these things right. Mm. If you look at something that we sometimes think is culturally important, is to be straight, not gay. And so when the children get declare that they're gay, how many parents have said, well, you're not my son, you're not my daughter. Mm-hmm. I've met people that have said that, and then they're outcast from at least a nuclear family community or maybe the church community, whereas some of the primitive cultures accept that. So it's not just in Africa. Mm-hmm. It happens in every culture.
And so how do we then?
Say that there are certain medical complications, so that it could be a medical danger for the girls? Maybe that, because we, you know, maybe our culture has some answers for these medical problems that they have, and we could approach it like that, saying, if you could stop doing this, you'd have a higher percentage of girls who would be surviving or who would be healthier or whatever those medical issues might be. Because, you know, as we've learned how clean water is important, and we've tried to help other countries and South America and other places, every place that hasn't had the chance to have clean water, and how that can improve health. Maybe approach it on a kind of a health system, that it's not just necessarily because of your culture, but there are some other reasons to reconsider.
I think that's a very good point. The challenge of that, though, is that many of the practitioners don't have access to primary health care as a whole. So it would mean that we would have to supply them with basic primary health first, and then start talking about the complications. Because these are communities. In fact, one of the challenges for people working in remote communities is the kinds of items used for the circumcision itself, and with HIV/AIDS. The spread from the knife from one person to another. Mm-hmm. And so that would be an excellent way, if they didn't see people dying of simple diseases like diarrhea or malaria, you know, they said, well, they'll die anyway, you know. So it's almost become, death has become part, or medical complications have become part of the everyday. So if you came in and said, well, this is a medical issue, they say, well, yes, but we're dying of malaria, you know, we're dying of diarrhea. You know, kids are not being immunized. You know, they're dying of, by the age 5, very few kids have survived in that region. So it is a big challenge. It's a very, very big challenge. And then, of course, you get the other counter argument that, well, let's take the Sudan, for instance, where there's the most extreme form of circumcision. And there's an argument, I remember reading somewhere that said that in that year alone, women and children, about 250,000, either died or suffered from hunger. And to take up an issue of circumcision as an important one was to be hypocritical, because one, I think Sudan had gotten economic sanctions through the U.S. And so somebody was saying, well, what did you do to stop your government from imposing these sanctions that led to these women, you know, starving? Right now, I mean, women and children are being raped and killed in Darfur, you know? And so, again, it becomes another issue of which do we apply to first? Yes?
So it seems like relationship, no matter where you are, is really important. So for any change to be taken place, it seems that there has to be a relationship in there. There has to be trust. Mm-hmm. And with what you're saying, if you would go in knowing that you're not going to change the circumcision, the practice of circumcision, because they're worried about losing their children to whatever disease, then you build this relationship up with them and help them, give them, vaccinate them, help them with their food supply or whatever, where you build a trust, where they trust you, and you're educating them at the same time, and maybe that's an approach to change. I don't know.
Yeah, and to follow on that, at least the little documentation that I've read of success stories in change has come through women becoming much more economically independent. Mm-hmm. And then they're able to make certain choices. They can send their daughters to boarding school outside of the community, and they are exposed to a lifestyle that is very different. I mean, there's a detriment to that, because then the daughters will never come back to build that community, because they'll fit, you know, in that. But they have started sort of a cycle that changes perception of, this is it. You know, I have to live here, I have to go through all these traditions. And once they become economically independent, it is amazing what decisions people can make when they know where to find the next meal. But when they don't, when they see that, you know, the children die, when they see the children going hungry, they are very much tied to decisions that almost look irrational to us. And I always tell my students, planning is a luxury. You know, planning is probably an invention of middle class. Because you can plan, you have enough. You can say, hey, I can keep this to eat tomorrow. But when you're only getting one meal, you know, and that's why you find probably people live in poverty. When they get a lot of money, they spend it immediately. You know, because hey, they're used to not having money, and you thought, why would you keep this money and use it little by little over time? And it's amazing that it is an issue, because people who are poor are not used to that, and so making those kinds of transitions where you're comfortable. You know that you can actually survive 5, 10, 20 years on resources that you have, then you start making decisions that will affect your relationship with your culture, and you start changing that culture. We say that culture, all cultures change. Yes, Jeff.
I just following what you're saying, I'm just really interested in this notion that economic advancement always comes at the cost of culture.
Yes.
And is there a way to sustain culture and yet to advance economically? The evidence is not much there, it seems, in much of Africa. And I am thinking now, of course, of Achebe in particular in West Africa and in Nigeria, where his books are all about that very cost.
Yes.
To advance, ultimately you're losing your sense of culture.
Yes.
So.
That has come as the side effect, where the example I'm giving, where you have to move away in order to make it. And the sad thing is that moving away is not a problem. It is the not coming back. Because you can move away and come back and say, you know what, I am part of this, I speak the language, I have the same mannerisms, but I think we can do this differently. And you become a model for other younger people who say, okay, I want to be like so-and-so's daughter or son, or, you know, then they'll change. But as soon as you move away, you get connected to an urban life, you get connected to other things, and you start despising the area you came from. And so there's no continuity.
There are examples of the other way, though, and I look at the Native American casinos generate tons of money, and where I live, they've spent the money on schools where they teach the kids culture, and people have come back to the culture and have come back to where they grew up. So they actually have more people there that are, and the culture is stronger. And I'm not saying gambling's good, but that's one of the good things that comes out of it. Their culture is much more evident than it was 30, 40 years ago.
So the economic advancement allows them.
Yeah, but it was local
local economic advancement.
Are there individuals and organizations within the culture that talk about the negative aspects of it so that it's not people from somewhere else that come and say, this isn't good?
That is the other very important agent of change, that it's coming from within.
And that if there's some way for other people outside of the culture to be able to support those individuals or groups or whatever.
Yes. Once it comes from the inside, because you will listen more to a person who you know, who lives there, who goes through, you know, I always tell people, if you want to change somebody, you have to be able to cry with them, laugh with them, live with them, so that they can trust you. Somebody talked about trust. So that they can trust you and say, okay, you really care about my life. And some of the, like I know there are movements in the Gambia where women from the community who are themselves circumcised refuse to circumcise their daughters. And they give specific reason. They say, well, we are preparing them for a broader world than where we are now. And that has helped local women to start thinking twice about what they expect of their own daughters.
What started those women from doing that? I mean, what instigated them to start saying, I don't want my daughter circumcised?
I think that there was a social worker or somebody who came from another community that doesn't circumcise girls, and was going there to work on something very different. I think it was vaccination for the children, and started talking to these women, and they got to know her well, and she stayed there, and she told them, you know, you run up, we don't do this, and they said, wow, you mean there's a group of people who don't do this? How come? You know, and then they said, well, there are all these complications and all these things, so you don't have to do it. And over the years, I think a few women have bought the idea, and we hope that this is something that will move on, you know, and become part of the community. Yes.
Again, from my trip 2 years ago, we visited a lot of women's projects that Lutheran World Relief and other Christian agencies are involved in. And, you know, education. If this young woman who would have to leave, what would she do? But if you've been able to go to school, if you've been able to learn a trade, if you can earn your own money, then that's not so scary.
Yeah.
Then you can say, I don't want to do that, and if you have to leave, you have to. So that women, for the first time in their lives, are learning the trade so they can sew, or they can tailor clothes or do computers, mm-hmm. or young women were learning to be preschool teachers, mm-hmm. to go back and teach school, they have some worth. If you're only a slave, you know, you don't.
About 22 years ago, we had a program from the university for people in Somalia. They had a number of classes actually in Mogadishu, and then when they reached a certain point, they brought a class over to California. And I don't remember, there were maybe 15 or so in the class. And one of those women had a book about female circumcision. And it was a book describing the whole thing, and it was kind of a plea to the outside world of, you know, just letting people be aware of how terrible it was. And she made it a point to try to pass it along to as many of the women on staff as possible. But the irony of the whole thing was, when it was time to go home, there was nobody there. They had all dispersed and become illegals within the country because nobody wanted to go back.
So nobody would take the message back. Yes.
I was wondering if you're familiar with the Arusha Maasai Girls School in Tanzania?
No.
Because it's kind of a house of refuge for girls like this in a school, and I was just wondering if you had information that would say if they really do prepare them for going back into their communities or for staying out, because people like uncles of the girls would smuggle them away from the community and let them go to school and revisit.
Yeah, I know of a similar a school ran by a Maasai woman, and she takes girls who are not only being almost getting circumcised, but also who are being forced into early marriages. And in times of scarcity of food, there's always a tendency to want to expand your social links. So you marry your daughter to somebody who's wealthy, who has more cattle, and will probably support you in times of need. So girls, by the time they finish eighth grade, instead of going on to secondary school, quickly married off by the father. So I know there's a school that does that. And what she's doing is she is looking for other local sponsors who are willing to at least pay school fees for the secondary school, because primary education is free, at least in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and pay for secondary education. And what happens is that once they become resourceful themselves, then some families tend to forget that they were taken away, because then become a source of income for the family. You know, and you have it's almost a reverse where they're being welcomed in, because they become school teachers, you know, or they're working as secretaries or clerks in the city, and they have money to send their siblings to school. So but before that, before you do that, you know, there's always that temptation to just say, take them out of school, marry them off. Of course, before they marry, they get circumcised. Yeah. And what can we do as people so far away, who are so far away from where it is?
Spread the word.
Spread the word.
Happening.
Yes. Did you get others? What else?
I think also focusing on local problems as well. As Emma was saying over here, talking about, you know, we have problems in our own societies that are really largely the same thing happening. Sort of that machismo or that, you know, that attitude that there's a certain way of being, there's this economic system and this way of society being in power, that's a worldwide problem. So I think if you're able to work within your own society on those issues, and you're educating yourself and helping yourself sort of become more aware of local problems, you're going to eventually become more aware of how to affect those world problems as well.
Mm-hmm. So it may take our own self-reflection here to transform other places. I mean, can you imagine if there was a big agenda to change how we consume here? And they say, let's say we everything, let's say if we consume 40% of what we don't need, transform that into change in another country. It means we don't take more out of the earth, we just redistribute what we have. And I've always been challenged to see how is it that my actions, wherever I am, affect someone else is very far away from where I am. And maybe that is one way of achieving it. One way of achieving it. And also there are a number of organizations that are genuinely trying to help, not in eradicating female circumcision, but in making poor communities self-sustaining. Because that is a key. I'm reading a book that we have assigned for first-year students that talks about this doctor who...
Mountains Beyond Mountains.
Yes, Mountains Beyond Mountains, by Kidder. That talks about doctors are the agents of social change because they want to change the economic realities of the people. And I mean, I've just read probably a third of it, but I can see that he realizes that people who are sick is more than just the disease in the body.
University of Washington is requiring every freshman student to read that book.
What is the name of it?
Mountains Beyond Mountains by Kidder.
Tracy Kidder.
Mountains. I think I saw a copy of it here.
Yeah,
you can look at it. It's in the bookstore. You can take a look and probably order it when. He says he's treating tuberculosis in Haiti, and he did almost a study, and he had two groups that he gave both the medication, and one group he gave them a $5 stipend for the month to buy other things, and there was 100% recovery on the group that had the $5 to supplement their income. So he's saying, you cannot just give them medication. You have to realize that they need to be have a source of livelihood so that they can keep not only with the regimen of their medication, but also have a world of what can we do, have a future, have a hope. I mean, we heard that now people are getting better and better through relationships. I think John DeGrasse presentation, I think on Monday or Tuesday, where he talked about this community which of immigrants from was it from Italy or
yes.
Yeah, that were very poor but lived the longest and had the fewer diseases just because they had strong relationships. You know? And so this is something that seems to be running now across the world, that yes, it is not just enough to have medication or to vaccinate the children. They have to be able to have a future through saying, we will have a meal tomorrow. We will be able to do this tomorrow. I can send my kids to school. I can go to the hospital on my own without, you know, always waiting for this. Mm-hmm. Any other comments before we break in 2 minutes?
I thought that's in the reference to Farmer brings it around in an interesting way, because you began with the case of an anthropologist who was questioning whether to get involved, and you end with a reference to a farmer who's a PhD anthropologist and
yes.
a medical doctor.
Yes.
He says you must be involved, and you cannot refrain.
You cannot.
Not in judgment, but
yes.
you have to be involved, a part of the community,
yes.
willing to move it toward change.
Yes, yes. And there's, I mean, over the years now, there's a branch of anthropology, we call it applied anthropology, where people actually work through to solve problems. We know of cases where there was forensic anthropologists who were able to show that a group of people in South America were killed by the government. And the government was saying it was just, you know, civil war between groups. And they said no. And they went, dug the graves, got the size of the bullets, traced them to the guns that were being used by the government then. So, of course, nothing was done to the then president, but the truth is out that this was done by your own government. And we can be involved in change.
I really think these efforts by Christian agencies to empower women,
yes.
Many of them are at home raising their kids and their husbands are gone
yes.
away, and
yeah.
they're now giving them loans
yes.
to start a little business. Their kids are able to go to school. They can buy a dress for themselves. You begin to feel like you're worth something.
Yes.
You empower them. I think those women's feelings about their children, about their daughters,
oh, yes.
is that their daughters can have a future too.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yes.
My congregation is involved with the Rubora Village Project. And you've got these kids in a Sunday school, and they wanted to do something for the kids in Rubora, so they held a bake sale.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they wanted the bake sale was the kids wanted to have fun while they were raising money. So they had a baking party. Raised $800 in an afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay. The people in Rubora had control over where the money went. The kids in the Sunday school also developed some pen pals over there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my jobs is to find Kenyan postage stamps so that nobody over there has to shell out.
Yes.
But the kids are talking back and forth now. It's we have been altered by what we've done there.
And I'm sure the kids in your Sunday school will be enriched as well as the kids there just knowing what, I mean, just ask them, tell me about your day. You know, I remember telling my students of a day of a young child in this location. The things you don't even think about, or things you take for granted, or things that you assume are always there, will change the way you perceive yourself in other places. Well, thank you very much. Our time is up.
Thank you.
And,